the End User, episode 129 for Tuesday, March 26th. Keep working on it. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I am Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. Chris, you must be really excited this week because you've topped our news stories with what I would call as blatant rumor mongering.
Sort of. I mean, it is blatant rumor mongering, but I think, you know, we actually had a leaked build of Windows Blue. So it's sort of Windows mongering, but there it is. There's a video. You can see it.
Right. So The Verge got their hands on this video preview of Windows Blue, which I guess that's the code name for the successor to Windows 8, right?
Sort of. So it's not like Windows 9. It's more like Windows 8 Service Pack 1 or Feature Pack 1, something like that. But they're adding a bunch of features. It's not just a lot of bug fixes. So it's a little bit different than saying it's the next version of Windows. But it is the first kind of update to Windows 8 that we're seeing.
So it's kind of more like an OS 10 update than a whole new version of Windows.
Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly right. So they're adding some features here and there, and they're tidying things up, adding a little polish, and hopefully it'll shine a little better than it was previously because it's currently a little rough. And I think they're making a lot of improvements in places where things were just rough, but they kind of worked.
Well, so, what were some of your favorite things that you saw in the video?
So, yeah, we'll go over a couple of my favorite ones. I think if you're really interested, you'll want to click through in the show notes to the link to The Verge. Tom Warren did a video demonstrating every single feature that we've seen leaked here. So, and it's also worth noting before we get into this that things are likely going to change when this is actually released. So we're kind of just getting a little preview of what's going on here. So right off the top, we've got Internet Explorer is getting a bump to version 11. And I guess they're going the route of Firefox and Chrome because that's kind of a fast release cycle. They typically don't do that.
Well, this seems to be a whole new kind of release cycle for Microsoft. Maybe they're changing everything about how they release their product updates.
No, Taylor. Reimagining.
Intel exploring?
Yeah, I suppose so. But they're shortening their release cycles and doing smaller updates. Like you said, like Apple was doing with OS X.
And everybody seems to be moving in that direction now. If Microsoft is doing it and everybody else is doing it, then everyone's doing it.
Yeah, definitely so.
But if everybody's doing it and Microsoft is not doing it, then it's still fringe. It's not mainstream.
So the little gem that caught my eye is that Internet Explorer 11 apparently will have the ability to sync tabs. So that's kind of interesting. You know, this is available on Android with Chrome, and it's kind of cool to see them add this. Although I've got to think that it's only going to work on Windows Phone and that it's not going to benefit a vast audience as such because, you know, Windows Phone, as much as I like it, is still only 3% of the market. So
that's kind of too bad. I love tab syncing. And in fact, with Chrome, you can sync between Android or iOS and Mac or PC. And any instance of Chrome, including iOS, that you're signed into can sync tabs. And then with Safari tab syncing, their cloud tabs, it works the same way. I guess you can't access your cloud tabs on an Android device, but you can get it on Mac, PC, and iOS.
Right, and do you think Microsoft's going to release Internet Explorer for iOS and Android? That seems unlikely to me.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, they did it for Apple way back in the day, but I don't think we're going to see it for iOS or Android. Maybe they'll decide to do a new one for the Mac, but I guess that's pretty unlikely, too.
Or is there any way, are there other apps that sync tabs between the Safari browser and iOS?
I'm sure that there are. I mean, you could use Pocket or Instapaper or something.
And our friend in the chat room there, Sean, brings up Xmarks, which was ditched by the company that originally made it. And I think it was open source, wasn't it? And I guess that can do tab syncing in Safari. So I guess they could figure out a way to kind of worm in there and get tab syncing onto Safari on iOS.
Well, my favorite tab sync system of all time was Delicious, but it's not what it used to be.
Yeah, yeah. So another interesting one, and I think this is the biggest one, is that when you have a Metro app in the snapped view, you can now do it in 50-50 splits, and depending on the resolution of your monitor, you can do like four apps or three apps side by side. And I think it's more along the line of what you would expect on a desktop and not on a tablet. I mean, you would never on a 10-inch screen put, you know, three apps side by side. That would be kind of insane. But I think they're adding this for using the modern UI or Metro UI on the desktop.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I think it's a good way to do it. I'm sure they can figure out a way to keep it in line with the whole tile scheme, you know, the modern UI. And it looks great in the video.
Yeah, I really like what I do currently with IM Plus is keep that docked off to the side if I'm on GChat or something. And I think with some other apps that aren't so amenable to being docked to a quarter of the screen, it'd be kind of cool to have, you know, my show notes up on one pane and some other kind of app on the other pane, like I do for the podcast or something like that. So I think that's probably the biggest change in all of these. So one other good one is the gesture to get to the start menu. You don't have to choose all apps from the charms bar. What you can do now is you can just slide up, and it will give you a list of all the apps installed on the system. So that seems like a good way of doing it.
I bet in the final release we're going to see even more, probably many more multi-touch gestures for this new version of Windows.
Yeah, definitely so. And I think that's a pretty good one. That is kind of reminiscent of Android, where you hit the kind of start style button on the bottom of the screen and you get all of your apps. It seems to make sense. So just like they did for Windows Phone, they're adding the ability to have large, medium, and small tiles. So that's a little, again, like I said, a lot of this is just kind of polish on top that was not possible previously, and it's good to see them add that kind of thing. And I really like the way this works on Windows Phone 8, so I'm glad to see it also wind up in full Windows.
So do they just have large and small right now on Windows 8?
They have large and medium, basically.
How do you know it's large and medium if there's no small?
So the small one is really just like an icon. It's just a link to the program. It's not going to give you any information. And then the medium ones are all of the not Metro apps. And some of the Metro apps also have this kind of medium view that give you like a couple numbers or something, and that's pretty much it, or maybe a picture, and that's kind of all you get. And then the larger one is what you're kind of accustomed to seeing with like the Mail app and that kind of thing.
All right. Well, maybe there's some sort of breakdown of design language that I'm not understanding here, but this seems like a glaring oversight, so it's good that they fixed it.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is the new philosophy of their release cycle, too, is we're going to see them kind of roll these things out over time. And the Windows 8 that we knew is but the first version. We'll see this kind of mature over time. And
so when you say roll things out over time, you mean fix glaring oversights?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a terrible idea.
I mean, you have to understand how new all of this is. This is the biggest change in Windows ever. And I think they are allowing themselves to kind of, you know, roll it out there and then fix it in post, I guess.
Well, they shouldn't. They're Microsoft. Get it in frame, guys. Get it in frame.
So another good thing is that they're expanding the amount of settings that you have access to in the modern UI interface. So stuff like networking stuff you previously couldn't get to. You'd have to open the desktop and use the Windows 7 kind of desktop to get at a lot of the settings. And a lot of those are just kind of being moved into the Metro settings. So that's good to see. Although, again, just polish. Now, one thing that caught my eye is there is an option for SkyDrive backups. So there's two options there. There's an auto upload for pictures and videos, just like on Windows Phone, which is nice. If you want to upload your pictures and videos immediately to SkyDrive, that's a good way to do it. But they also had this notion of SkyDrive backup. So I'm looking forward to see what that means, because I wonder if it's just the libraries, just the documents and that kind of thing. But it'll be interesting to see what SkyDrive backups means. So, you know,
well, documents, I would imagine that would be one of the most storage-intensive backup versions. I mean, if you had backups of just system settings or maybe some system restore points, that would be something that they could do, which would provide cloud security for people backing up their computers, but without taking up too much space on your SkyDrive.
And, you know, they've kind of starting to move away from Windows Home Server with them not releasing a Home Server 2012. And I wonder if this is kind of their answer to it. And that's the reason that they started to move away from 2011. So I've got to think that this is their solution for that, that they're not really expecting you to move up to the big boy server product to do backups, but they're expecting consumers to use SkyDrive for that. And that seems reasonable to me, right?
I guess it seems pretty different from Apple's backup philosophy, which is to make it easier and easier to backup locally the more Apple stuff that you buy.
Right. With Time Capsule you're talking about?
Right. Time Capsule is the router with a built-in hard drive, and it works with Macs to automatically do backups hourly.
Right. Well, one of the cool things about Home Server 2011 is that you could also do Macs.
Yes, I remember that, but I already had a Time Capsule.
Yeah, that's true. And also, if you're in an all-Apple ecosystem, I'm not sure it makes sense to have a Windows Home Server, right?
Probably not. I'm sure that there are others in the digital media zone who would know better than me.
Yes, I know specifically Richard is a Mac guy who uses Home Server. I don't remember if it was V1 or 2011, but there's always an exception, right?
Right.
But I think rolling backups into SkyDrive makes a ton of sense, and I can't wait to see how deep that backup goes, because if it's really superficial and it's just documents and pictures, then I'm a little less interested. But we'll have to wait and see what that means. So Taylor, you're going to love...
I think the goal of backups, and Apple has done this really well, not on the cloud side of it, but at least locally, it's backups that you don't have to initiate. They're initiated automatically, and it provides a full enough snapshot of your system that you can completely restore to the last backup and not have any interruption.
See, and I think that's not what this is going to be, if I had to make a guess.
Right. Well, it could be, but that would just be a ton of data that Microsoft would have to store in the cloud.
Right, right. So we'll have to wait and see on that one. We'll see,
especially since this is all blatant rumor mongering.
So they've also got an app called Quiet Hours where you can specify quiet hours just like your iPhone does.
Yes, much more important for phones than computers, but it's a good idea, and I approve of it.
Yeah, well, they've got notifications, so it makes sense that they give you a way to turn these things off. Again, polish. And right alongside that one, they've got, and we'll move a little more quickly through these, an alarm app, which is very simple. You just set an alarm. This is not something they had before. They've got a Metro calculator. You used to have to go to the desktop to get at a calculator. They've got the return of Sound Recorder, I suppose. You remember Sound Recorder?
Yeah, sure. Just the simple WAV file recording app.
Right. They've basically got a modern UI style app that can record sound. So I don't know if I'm moving away from Audacity anytime soon, but it's good to see that kind of basic functionality moved into the new Windows, if you will.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, people generally want those basic functionality recorders to record voice notes or something like that, or, you know, maybe just some snippet. I mean, it all provides the same thing, but if you address the interface and even the title of the app as to deal with voice notes, which is what Apple ended up doing, I think people are more likely to use it.
Yeah, that's probably true. If you organize it in a way that makes sense for somebody who's using it, instead of just being a general sound recorder, you couch it in an interface that makes sense for note-taking and the like, that kind of makes sense.
Right.
So lastly, they've got an app called Movie Moments, at least for the time being. Again, this is just a leak, so it's hard to say what if this is going to make it into the final Windows Blue. And it's basically Windows Movie Maker, but cut down to size. So it's really, really simple. All you can do is add text and really simple stuff. So
yeah, I'm not sure I know what Movie Moments is. I didn't watch that part of the video, but I love the name. I mean, an app called Movie Moments makes me want to use it way more than an app called Sound Recorder.
So I'd have to imagine that Microsoft, following in its own tradition, will name it something ridiculous once it actually comes out.
Well, I hope not. Movie Moments is a great app title.
Like Video Editor.
Oh, boy.
Hey, they've done worse than that.
Oh, yes, of course. I'm just saying, I like Movie Moments.
All right, and this is the last one, and then we can get into some more industry news. But on the keyboard, it was not available for you to touch the top key in the top left and get a pop-up menu for the number one. That was not something that was available, and that's something that you kind of come to expect from a modern tablet operating system, right? And that's just not something that was there. So, again, a tiny little improvement that I think polishes up the user experience for people.
Well, I'll take your word for it. Sounds like something you have to see in action.
Yeah, this is available on iOS, right?
I don't think so. It'd be cool if it was.
No, if you hold on the top key of the keyboard, it doesn't give you the number one. I know this is how it works on most Android phones.
What do you mean the top key of the keyboard? There's a whole row of top keys.
Well, are the top keys numbers?
No.
So if you hold down Q, it'll give you the number one.
I don't think it works that way on iOS.
Okay, well, they should add that too.
I suppose they should. I'm fine with it the way it is.
Well, I don't know. I think it's a nice little improvement. But, well, I'll stop rumor mongering for the time being. I'm sure we'll come back to this once we actually get real details. But that's what we can tell from the leaked build of Windows Blue. So that's kind of exciting if you're into the Windows 8 thing.
I just verified on my iPad, and at least on the iPad, there is no number access from the top row of the touchscreen keyboard.
Hmm. They should add that.
Well, then they would get into the fight about whether they stole it from Microsoft or Microsoft came at it from someone, but I don't know. If they had it, I would probably use it.
And it's also not, by the way, not on Windows Phone either, so... maybe I overstated the presence of this a little bit, but it's. I think it's.
I think you did. Maybe this is novel. Maybe this is a good idea that they were the first ones to have.
Well, no. So it's been up on Android forever. So they're definitely not the first ones to have it. But it's good to see them get it, I suppose.
Well, speaking of Android, there is a new app that Google has come out called Google Keep. Ties right into their ecosystem. Everything goes right into Drive. It's basically a competitor for Evernote. It's something where you can keep notes of things and record any sort of information, and it'll go right into your Google Drive. They just came out with it this past week, and it's only on Android for now, although there is also a way to enter notes directly into the Keep folder of your Google Drive. But it'll probably expand to other platforms soon.
Yeah, I've got to imagine that they will put this out on other platforms, right?
Yeah, they would have to want people to use it.
One of the biggest advantages of using Evernote is that it's freaking everywhere.
Yes, absolutely.
And I got a chance to play around with the web interface for a minute. And, you know, it seems really simple. It seems like the first version of a product. It definitely... you know, it's not everywhere. It's not going to have the maturity of Evernote. It's not really something you should expect. But it's kind of neat to see them step in here with this. I'm not sure they can compete with Evernote unless they iterate on this very, very, very rapidly. And it is interesting to see them roll this out. And, you know, they've already got Docs. And this is like a more specific version of Docs for you to... kind of throw everything into it, like images from your Android phone and voice notes and that kind of thing. So
what's Docs, Chris?
Oh, that's right. I will never stop calling it Docs for some reason. Google Drive, you're right.
So Google has officially rebranded Google Docs into Google Drive, and they don't call it Google Drive anywhere anymore. But you can still go to docs.google.com or google.com/docs, and it'll take you to Drive. If they ever remove that feature, they are going to use a lot. They're going to lose a lot of Google Drive users.
Yeah, and as long as they keep that redirect in there for docs.google.com, that's kind of my twitchy muscle memory on the keyboard that I go to. So maybe I should make a conscious effort to stop doing that and stop calling it Docs.
Well, as a journalist, you probably should make an effort to call it what it's called.
So I don't know. Do you think that if this came out for iOS, would you use it, do you think?
Well, I don't really use any universal note-taking applications. I kind of just use the built-in notes app on iOS for general notes. And if it's a photo or a video or something else, or you know, a voice recorder, I'll use a different app for that. My mind just compartmentalizes things. I don't like ditching stuff in a junk drawer, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, because Evernote and Google Keep now are both kind of a bucket for everything. It's not very specific.
Yeah. So I might change that in the future. I've always been intrigued by Evernote, and I would be able to record a lot more things in my life if I use something like that. But for now, I just use a bunch of specific apps. I have way too many apps.
So, yeah, I've seen your home screen, and it's kind of ridiculous, I must say. So do you think Google will kill this eventually? That is what everybody should be asking themselves at some point here, right, since they're killing off Reader. I'm of two minds of this because I feel like there's some knee-jerk reaction to Google killing off Reader, and I see where it's coming from, but I'm not so sure we should be skeptical of everything that Google puts out now. And this is one that strikes me as something that they will kill in the future, though, isn't it?
At this point, I'm just assuming everything in Google is a time bomb. But, you know, everything that they delete, they will try to bring it up in some other place.
Right. And it's kind of a funny arrangement here, but Microsoft has OneNote, you know, for iOS and for Android and for Windows Phone. And Google is more platform specific than Microsoft in this one regard.
I think Google is more platform specific than Microsoft in a lot of regards.
What, you mean with Android?
I don't know. I mean, everything is built around the Google platform. You know, it's everything that has a web interface, you're still using Google's platform.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But I just mean this OneNote is available for all the platforms and this Google Keep is not.
Oh, I see what you're saying. And Evernote's available for all
right.
platforms.
Yeah, and Evernote's
I think that's
is available
just because
for,
this is
for...
brand new. I will not at all be surprised to see rapid expansion and rapid innovation with Google Keep.
Yeah, so we'll have to keep an eye on it. But if you want, we've got the link in the show notes that takes you to the Google Play Store if you'd like to check it out and check out their little web interface. Again, simplicity is key with this thing. If that's not what you want, if you want a bucket of features, then you're definitely not going to like this. You're going to like Evernote.
Yeah, you're not going to like this yet.
Not yet. Maybe in a few years or something.
Unless you're really dependent on your Android phone and your Google Drive.
Which actually sounds like a lot of people, right?
Well, I'm sure that there are a lot of people who haven't used an Android phone and Google Drive, but the number of people who are truly dependent on it, I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe. Well, speaking of a little number of users, we've got some news about T-Mobile. What's going on here? This looks interesting.
Yeah, so we've reported for the last few months that they've been changing their business strategy. At first, they were trying to sell their business in the United States. And so now, in the U.S., they are offering completely new plans. They are based on the idea that people are tired of getting locked into two-year contracts, and so it's a contract-free option, and it's really pretty simple. For $50 a month, you could get unlimited calling and texting with 500 megabytes of high-speed data. You can pay more, $10 more for two gigabytes more. But at $70, you can just get unlimited everything. And that includes tethering, which I think is great. Every mobile carrier should have free tethering, particularly if you are paying by the gigabyte.
Right. Now, I think this is – I love this because, as you know, I've been on a Verizon grandfathered plan for a long time now. It's about $70 a month, and it is unlimited data. And it, I think T-Mobile is really trying to get off the treadmill of the subsidy method, and it's very interesting to see them try this. Now, will it succeed? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they have to try something, and T-Mobile seems to want to break this two-year carrier subsidy where everybody is just stealing customers from everybody else every 2 years, and it might work. It'll take 2 years for them to find out, but in the meantime, they are not sitting still. They're not going to just have these new contract-free plans and see if they work. They are also testing a new LTE network, and this is going to be compatible with many LTE devices that are currently on AT&T, and they have already launched LTE networks in at least 9 cities. Furthermore, they are expected to announce this week details on official iPhone availability on the T-Mobile network, as opposed to buying one on another carrier or unlocked and bringing it into a T-Mobile store to have it activated on their network.
Yeah,
which will be really great because that means that they will finally be able to get, well, presumably they'll finally be able to get visual voicemail.
Right. Now, I think it's crucial to their business that they roll out LTE, and this is like the first step. So it's good to see that happen. And I really like seeing them experimenting with the kind of prepaid subscription model of not subsidizing phones. I'm really encouraged by this because I think that's how it should work. I think the carrier should be a dumb pipe, and I think that you should buy a phone and use it on that carrier, and that is how you can increase competition. But it's not what we have now in the United States, and this, to me, is some small step forward in that. And I would like to see other carriers follow in line, but I know it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yes, but 2 years from now, if this turns out to be a successful business model, we could see all of the carriers shift towards this.
Right, absolutely. And it's T-Mobile's job as the little guy to poke at the big guys and disrupt the market, right?
Yeah, that's true. Although they would disrupt the market of trying to get people to pay for unlimited calls and texts when we really don't want that for the most part.
I don't know. I think there's something to be said for just paying $70 a month and being done with it and not worrying about any kind of overages. It's a huge hassle to keep track of your data. And by the way, Windows Phone has a feature called DataSense that will stop you if you get close to your data cap. So, you know, I haven't had much use for it, but for people who are on limited data plans, it's incredibly useful. But
I get emails when anyone on my plan gets close to the limit, and that comes from AT&T. There's nothing inherent to my device that do that, although I'm sure there are apps.
Oh, I'm sure there are, yeah.
That can do that for you.
But I
would rather just pay per minute and per text while still having a set amount of monthly data, whether limited or unlimited.
Yeah, I guess what grinds me about that is that it's not – there's no technical reason for that, right? And that's kind of the sphere that I come from. So I think that it really grates upon me to pay for a single text message when a single text message in the use of bandwidth of the cell phone is really minuscule. It was designed to be minuscule. It was designed to take a little side channel of the voice spectrum and eke out, you know, a bunch of characters, and that was it. And then they figured out that this was actually very useful and started charging for it. So I don't know. Maybe I just need to get with the times.
Well, as someone trained in economics, it really bothers me to pay for 450 cell phone minutes a month, not including unlimited mobile-to-mobile nights or weekends, when I only end up using 14. And now you're saying instead of 450, I should pay for unlimited and be happier with it.
No, I'm saying the idea of cell phone minutes shouldn't exist. period.
Well, yeah, that would be great if they could just bill us per unit of information transferred on an equal level.
Because it's purely a business model. It has nothing to do with the technology behind it.
Absolutely. And either way, although we disagree on the specifics, I think we both agree that the consumer is getting gouged.
Absolutely. They are getting gouged. And I think this is T-Mobile's first step into either prodding the bigger companies to offer something similar or having some great success themselves.
Well, we'll know in about 2 years, if not sooner.
Yeah, I guess we will. So we'll check back in a couple of years. Well, probably sooner than that, but...
I'm sure we'll have updates before that.
With that, let's turn on the afterburners.
Okay, I'm locked and loaded. Facebook is implementing threaded comments on posts on pages and on popular profiles. I wish that they would do this for everyone. Why wouldn't you want the ability to use threaded comments? That's where you can respond to someone's comment specifically and start a new subthread as opposed to just one single list of comments.
Right. I definitely think this is a good thing. And Facebook does this thing where they only roll out to a subset of users, and that's what you're seeing here. So not everybody's going to see it, and it'll kind of roll out over time. And that's what they do with all the features. But you're frustrated by this?
I just think that they should implement it everywhere. I don't think anyone would be particularly bothered by having threaded comments in all Facebook posts.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Well, Apple has released another update to iOS 6. This is 6.1.3. They released it last week. It's available. It can't be jailbroken, so don't update if you plan on jailbreaking. Don't install the update if you've already jailbroken. It fixes that lock screen passcode vulnerability that allowed people to get access to your contacts and your data, although another one has already been discovered, and I guess we'll have to wait for 6.1.4 for that one to be fixed.
Why can't they get this right? This is crazy.
I don't know. I guess they're just worried about someone being locked out when they shouldn't be would be much worse than an obscure vulnerability from Apple's perspective, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know about this one, but they need to fix this, and I need to never see this again.
Well, they have already found like three more on the Samsung Galaxy S3. So we're not only seeing this in the iPhone.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. And I bet you it exists on Windows Phone too. But
right.
We're just obscure. So anyway.
In other Apple security flaws, they had to take down their I Forgot Password reset on the internet because there was a security hole that anyone with someone's Apple ID and birthday could gain complete access to someone else's account. However, they have also rolled out this week two-step authentication for Apple ID login.
Nice.
And this is totally voluntary, but you should enable this in all of your devices whenever possible.
Right. So you do this with Google right now, right?
I do this with Google right now, and I've also implemented it with Apple. Apple is really great because you can just specify which device you want to send a custom code to, and Apple just messages it to you automatically.
Nice. That's the way to be.
Yeah.
That vastly increases the security of your devices.
And one more piece of Apple news. They've updated their podcasts app as a pretty minor thing. They got rid of the little reel-to-reel podcast animation, they've added a couple of new features like special stations, playlists within the podcast app that you can sync with iTunes. But my favorite part is that it will sync your podcast play positions or whether you've listened to it or not through iCloud to all iOS devices and to iTunes. So I can have the same or different podcasts on my Mac, my iPad, and my iPhone, and sync them across each device and never have to listen to the same podcast twice or mark it as read myself. Previously, I had to do this through iTunes. So I'm really happy that all of this is automatic now.
Definitely. And I think this is going to be a trend, you know, now that we're kind of stepping away from the infancy of cloud computing and actually getting useful things done like this. I think we'll see more of this kind of thing from more companies and more products. So I'm looking forward to that day. So Barnes & Noble is offering a free Nook Simple Touch with their a purchase of their Nook HD Plus. On the bright side,
through March 30th.
Right, through March 30th, and the HD Plus costs $269 for their base model, and you get the Nook Simple Touch, which is about $80, more in line with the Kindle. So there are two sides to this. You can either say, well, they just can't sell the Nook Simple Touch, so they want to get rid of them and get them in people's hands to increase their presence of ecosystem, or you could look at it as a good deal.
Yeah, it's a very good deal. If you wanted a tablet and an e-ink reader, you can't do any better than this.
Yeah, I suppose so. So for a limited subset of people that are interested in that kind of thing, this is a pretty good deal. But I also think that they just weren't selling the Simple Touch versus the Kindle very well.
Oh, that's definitely the reason they're doing it.
Yes. All right, and with that, let's turn off the afterburners and let's get into the end user stories. We've had a top-heavy show, so we've only got a couple stories left, but let's get into them. What you got for us?
Okay, well, I think we reported this on the show before. Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos has set up a foundation called Bezos Expeditions, and he announced that he was searching for and had found the F1 rocket engines used by the Apollo program. Specifically, he was looking for the ones used in Apollo 11 when they launched on their way to landing on the moon. So they've been there for almost 45 years, and he has now started bringing pieces of them up. Apparently, he can't identify most of the parts because there's a lot of damage and a lot of corrosion. But they are working to clean them up, get them to showroom condition, and hopefully identify which parts and which rockets they came from.
Yeah,
so I think this is just really cool, and it's amazing and a little bit surprising to me how dedicated they are just to have this available for public display.
Yeah, I'm enjoying watching Jeff Bezos's transition into Lex Luthor.
Well, he's already got the shaved head.
Yeah, I suppose he does. And by the way, I really think that this is a really good idea. We should bring these things up. They should be in a museum. They should be able to be studied and seen. And they're a part of our history. So I think it's a fantastic thing to dig them up out of the ocean. So applause to Jeff Bezos and team for doing this when there's not that much that they can gain out of this. You know, this is kind of an expedition for the people.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, I think Jeff Bezos probably has a plan to derive some sort of profit out of this.
I'm sure.
But they were found in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Florida, as one might expect, about 14,000 feet down, which is much farther than human divers can go. So just to be able to get down there and look at them, they had to send robotic subs. And to be able to bring these pieces back up using robotic subs and manipulator arms was really complicated. But fortunately, they had one of the guys who was working with the guy who found the Titanic.
Yeah, so this is really cool to see. So that's really our only the end user story of the week. So let's get into some green tech action. Windmills more efficient once again?
Yes. Well, efficiency is a difficult thing to measure. But if you measure it by how much wind area you can get from one windmill, this is definitely the most efficient because it is the biggest windmill that's ever been made in the world. A single blade is wider than the wingspan of an A380 jumbo jet. And this has three of them, and it will be 154 meters across, and so that is a combined wind catching area of 18,600 square meters. It'll generate 6 megawatts. That's 65% more electricity than any wow. previous windmill model. And they're not just building one of these for a test case. They plan to build 300 of them.
Wow. So where are they they don't know where they're going to put these things yet?
These are probably going to be offshore. I mean, they're very, very big. It would be it would take up a lot of land if they were to put them in land.
So the reason that you want to make them large is because the larger, slow-moving turbines have more surface area for wind to go across them, thus generating more power. Do I have that correct?
It's not so much about surface area. It's about the area that they cover as they're spinning. So that's how you measure it. For every foot that you add on to the length of the rotor, you get, you know, 1 foot times pi in terms of added wind resistance.
Cool. So this is they've got a good picture in the article we're passing along. So head into the show notes. They've got the airplane that you just talked about flying like directly alongside this thing. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's just a diagram, not a real airplane. But,
right.
They also have a picture of just one of the turbine blades under construction, and it is truly massive.
Yeah, that's pretty wild looking. All right, so let's get into our tip of the week. And once again, you've got us covered, but it's a Windows 8 tip. So what do we got?
Yeah, I don't know all that much about this. I just thought it seemed pretty cool. In OS 10 Mountain Lion, I definitely have a USB recovery disk. It's a drive that I can plug in and boot up, and it's saves me a bunch of times. I had to use one this week. So when I saw that Lifehacker posted how to build one for Windows 8 and that you could also save some hard drive space in the process, I thought, well, that's something that Windows users should definitely know about.
Right. So I haven't done this on any of my installations yet, but I know people were doing this for their Surfaces because the Surface's hard drive was very limited in space because Windows 8 takes up a healthy amount of space. And so you could pull out the recovery partition onto a USB pen instead of having it just be a separate partition of the drive. So that's how you're saving space in this case.
Aha. Uh-huh. See, OS 10 has both the drive partition right. and the optional ability to make the USB drive.
So that's what they're talking about here, and if you're sensitive to disk space, it's a pretty good option. I think it's also just a good option to have a USB pen that you can stick into this thing, and just like in OS 10, you can boot to the recovery partition as long as you haven't wiped it out in this way, and recover the hard drive from that. So I've got some options, I suppose.
Yeah, so it's nice to have options. And if you are a Windows 8 user, you should definitely check this out and maybe consider doing it so you can save some space or maybe just to have an extra backup.
Cool. And we have an app pick of the week. And this is more in your realm.
This is much more my style.
This is something I know nothing about.
Well, we've talked about these types of apps. That is something that implements into your system and you can use keyboard shortcuts to do a lot of different shortcuts to different things in your system. I'm not explaining this very well, but I'm talking about Quicksilver, which was one of the original keyboard shortcut apps for Mac, and it has been in development since 2003, and it has been in beta this entire time, but it's finally come out of beta, so I thought I would mention Quicksilver again, because you can get version 1.0 now for Snow Leopard, Lion, or Mountain Lion.
Yeah, Quicksilver has been no secret on the Mac that it's a fantastic thing to have. I can't believe they were still in beta. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
They're taking the Gmail approach to beta.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah,
so any Mac power user has definitely dabbled in Quicksilver before if they don't use it constantly.
And if you haven't dabbled in it before, now is the time.
Absolutely. You don't want to be a beta tester. Well, some people do. But if you don't, and that's what you were waiting for, you don't have to wait anymore. Your time has come. Join us.
So I've always wondered this question, Mr. Marr. What happens in one internet minute?
Well, according to that 90s cartoon show reboot, like every minute, like a game cube drops into the mainframe, and then they have to role play some sort of game and defeat the user. Is that what you're talking about? The show reboot?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about, and that sounds fantastic. Oh,
okay. Well, another way of looking at it is this new Intel infographic that explains, in terms of metrics, all of the different things that are happening on our current internet every minute. So, for example, the total amount of data transferred per minute is 640 terabytes.
Wow. So this is I'm kind of imagining the internet is quite large, and I think that's a large amount of data, but isn't that going to explode over time? It's quite impressive, but this is going to be like Moore's Law, isn't it?
Well, they have some predictions about what it's going to look like in a few years, 2015 specifically, and I'm sure they're using Moore's Law. I mean, Intel is famous for exploiting and not imploding under Moore's Law.
Right.
And profiting from it.
That's pretty cool. It's like a slice of the internet. It is kind of hard to believe that that's all in measuring everything in 1 minute. It's impressive.
Right.
So, yeah, so to see what we're talking about, you really have to go to the show notes and click through for the graphic. The graphic really makes it.
Every minute, 30 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube.
that's crazy.
Now I'll never get through it all.
Yeah, it's over. You can't consume it all. It's impossible.
You can't win.
You can't win. So now, curiously, I don't see Clefarf on this infographic.
Well, they're small right now, but oversight? They'll be bigger later. Yeah.
An oversight?
But I do see Twitter on there.
Oh, yeah. Well, Twitter is like some kind of nervous system for the internet or something. So that makes sense. All right. So if
I were to get a hold of you on Twitter, Chris, how would I do that?
You could get at me at Chris Hale Barnes. And if somebody were to try to get at you.
Hang on. I got to write this down. At me at Chris Hale Barnes. Okay, I got it.
Okay, good. So what is your Twitter handle, and how would somebody use that Twitter handle to get at you?
Well, I suppose it's what's at the end of the handle, which in my case is at TaylorPhone.
Yeah, there we go. And on Clefarf?
It's unpronounceable. We've been over this.
All right, so you'll just have to search for him on Clefarf, I suppose.
Yeah, you do a cognitive input query using your implant.
Right. Yeah.
It's really simple.
Yeah,
you'll understand all of it, you know, when you get there.
Once you get the cognitive implant, all will make sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that will do it for this week. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. Have a look at Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. You can also send us some feedback if you'd like. TheEndUser@thedigitalmediazone.com is our email. You can ping us on Twitter. We are at TheEndUser. And we do the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So please join us in the chat room. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Hey, does your cognitive implant ever make your Google Glass itch?